Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
The spring buying season this year is already off to a pretty good start as of this morning, which is great to see. And if that continues, that'll be helpful to storage.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host, Joe Cornwell, and today I'm joined by Ryan Smith. Ryan is the principal at Elevation Capital Group. They are investing in some different types of real estate assets, including mobile home communities, storage facilities, and he was also a previous baseball player and software developer. So I know it's been several years since you've been on the show, Ryan. Thank you for joining us and coming back. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So let's get into your background. I guess let's go way back. I know you said you started a software company at 13. Why don't we start with that and then how you transitioned into real estate from there?
Sure, happy to. So I'm kind of tree-topping it. My family was in the real estate as a secondary kind of business. My dad worked a day job to build. We were very blue-collar and to kind of set ourselves up financially. We started buying rundown properties in questionable neighborhoods that are now unbelievable neighborhoods. So every weekend we'd be at the property scraping, digging, trenching, all that stuff, schlepping. So anyway, I was exposed to real estate at a young age, getting my hands dirty, enjoyed it, loved it. Started helping him with his underwriting and financial analysis in my early teenage years. And then set out to create an application for him to be able to use for himself as a way for me to set myself free from the basement one day, maybe. So anyway, I wrote him an application, took me 4 months, and ended up becoming an application that over 100,000 people use to analyze their real estate investments. So he liked it, worked for him, he liked it, told a friend it worked for others, and it was a great experience.
That's interesting. Let me give you my example. You tell me how it relates. I have a spreadsheet I made that was like a deal matrix, and basically it just spits out all the numbers. I plug in all the details, the data, spits out numbers, gives me my return on equity, my cash on cash, my IRR, all that stuff. Pretty rudimentary system, but basically just helps me evaluate deals year over year. I try to update it once a year. For example, this year I'm going to end up selling two properties just because I have so much equity that I can't really access and I'm going to sell it because of that. Is it something similar or completely different?
It was similar. This was around 93, 94. It was similar to that. It did more than that in that you could also put in the deal parameters, the variables, and then your desired outcome. And then it would calculate various ways that you can actually do the deal, starting with the end in mind, kind of an early version of GoalSeek, and kind of tell you how to do the deal in order to get what you want based on the variables. So yeah, it was a nice deal room for somebody to toy around with purchase scenarios and various outcomes.
So you were underwriting before underwriting was cool, so to speak.
I was creating the software that helped people underwrite. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which
gotcha.
Was kind of fun.
Yeah. Awesome. I saw in your bio you had a baseball background. You want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm 6'8". It's hard to tell that from a podcast, but I'm super tall, had a good arm. I was a two-sport athlete, basketball, baseball, threw 94 miles an hour in high school. Got drafted by the Orioles out of high school, and subsequent to that by the Angels. I played baseball all the way through college and continued to build my software company that I eventually sold. I kind of was this athlete slash nerd, which was kind of fun.
Very cool. And then how did you transition into actually buying and investing in real estate on your own?
I graduated college. I really didn't want to play professional sports. It was a simple hang up, but my hang up was I didn't want to be a product on somebody else's shelf. It's a big difference playing sports in college and playing professional. You're purchased, you're traded. I struggled with that. So anyway, I decided to go entrepreneurial route. I liked real estate, obviously, was pretty good at underwriting it, analyzing it. I had cash in the bank because of my software company. My wife, we started the company together. She had pretty extensive property management background. So we went out to start in real estate. I convinced her not to go to law school and to join me in building the business. So we ended up buying in our early 20s about 30 houses with the goal of long-term ownership. And we got to roughly 30 and found it wasn't as scalable as we had hoped it would have been. And so at that point, you have the decision. You're like, okay, well, I thought it'd be scalable by now. Do I go to 100 and hope it appears? So anyway, that's kind of when we started poking around for other better pathways. So anyway, we ended up spending a long weekend. We created an underwriting for every asset, like a standard underwriting model around every asset class that we could think of. So office, retail, billboards, mobile home parks, apartments, motel, hotel, retail, the gamut. We spent a long weekend doing it. And our thought was at the end of the weekend, we'd put all the models on the table, let the models duke it out and pursue the ones that had the most merit around four key points. And the four key points for us at the time were: we wanted assets that generated good and predictable cash flow. So we wanted cash flow. We wanted predictability as much as it could be had. So kind of cycle resilient, low beta we were looking for. So that's the second point. Third is capital appreciation opportunities through net operating income growth and or multiple expansion, cap rate compression over time, institutionalization. And then we wanted tax benefits. So those were the four things we were looking for. And the two asset classes that really figuratively jumped off the table were storage and mobile home parks. So that's when we started buying mobile home parks, because in those days you could pretty frequently buy mobile home parks for 20 plus or minus cap, in some cases higher.
What year was that? Did you start?
I was around 2003, 2004.
Okay. So did you form your company Elevation Capital at that point, or was that later?
That was later. I'll jump to the simple answer is we didn't start Elevation Capital until I think it was 2013 in response to the Jobs Act. Is that's when general solicitation was allowed. And prior to that, we could not generally solicit as friends and family. And so there was really no need for a company like Elevation Capital prior to 2013, unless you were going through your broker distributed or some other type of distribution model.
Okay. So how many properties were you buying and selling over that 10-year span from the time you jumped into mobile home parks into starting a fund?
Between the two points, I think it was in total, some of them we bought and flipped pretty quickly, but I think it was around 15 in total, excluding the residential that preceded it.
Okay. And did you hold on to the single families indefinitely, or did you end up selling those?
We actually still own a lot of them now. We actually still own some of the mobile home parks we bought in that time frame.
So if you don't mind, I think this would be helpful for the audience, especially people of my generation, maybe in their 20s or 30s, that didn't see the last cycle. What roughly cost basis were you buying these properties for 20 plus years ago? And what do you think they're worth today?
It depends. There are properties, and I'm guessing because some of them I've sold, but as a general statement, you could have probably bought properties in the, call it $500,000 property back in 2005. All things being equal, might trade for 1.5 to 2 today.
In what market were these single families?
So those were mobile home parks in particular, but that's that comparison I was just giving. Cap rates have definitely compressed all things being equal since then. But yeah, where we started, we bought initially in Texas, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama.
Did you still have some of the single families that you initially started investing with, or did you sell?
Yes. I'm sorry. We still have single families that we started investing. Yeah. So I think the first single family I bought was around 200,000, and today it would probably trade for six to seven or so.
Okay. So about three times maybe equity, something like that. And what market were those?
Orlando, which is where I live.
Interesting. The reason why I asked that is you hear 5-8 years ago, very common thing was real estate is so expensive. Prices have come up too high. It's overvalued. Today, of course, that's the rhetoric from almost every level of investor. Prices are overvalued. At any point during your early investing career, so we're talking 20 to 25 years ago in that range, did it feel like when you were buying these properties, you were overpaying or they're overvalued?
It's very rare that you feel like you're getting an unbelievable discount. Even when you do get an unbelievable discount, you still question whether you made a mistake, because it's like, okay, what am I seeing that nobody else is seeing? So you never really enter a deal saying open, shut. You're always nervous on both ends of the spectrum. But we've definitely seen cycles where prices have declined relative to prior periods in 2004, 5, 6. And then you go into the GFC of 2008 to 2010, you definitely saw a lot of really good deals on the mobile home park side. And that's actually what precipitated and necessitated our forming our first fund in February of 2010, is we just saw more good deals than we had capital for. So we kind of either had to let them go or take advantage of them. So we chose to take advantage of them by forming our first fund.
Yeah, that's great. The reason I asked that question is the vast majority of investors I talk to day in and day out are post 2008 recession investors, right?
Yep.
A very small percentage of them, at least in my network, have been seeing the 80s, 90s, or 2000 cycles prior to the recession. So I love getting the perspective on when you look at enough of a timeline, time horizon on almost any type of real estate asset, it usually goes up, it usually increases in value over time. And obviously, you can pinpoint some times in the market where that didn't happen, or we had recessions and we had drop-offs in value. But I think it's also, what are your goals? What type of investing are you doing and why? And how long you plan on holding it? And that's going to obviously be a major factor in your strategy. Okay, so tell me a little bit more about your fund. So you said 2013 or so, you started raising money. And then how did that business grow until today?
Yeah, so we started our first fund in 2010. Our second one in approximately 2011, our third one in 2013, our fourth one roughly in 2014, fifth one 2015, sixth one 2016, and now we've done nine. So we've kept going. And I bet you can guess we have fund one all the way through fund nine. Our next one will probably be called fund 10. We're at a huge marketing department. Kidding. We have none. But anyway, we've done a number of funds. The first two were Reg D 506B, as in boy, no solicitation. Can accept a limited amount of unaccredited along with accredited investors. We never did. We were all purely accredited. And then we transitioned in 2013 to Reg D 506C, which is general solicitation, all accredited, verified as such. We've done a lot of deals. I think since then, I think in total, we've had ownership in probably 160 properties or so since then. So quite a number, more than 20,000 units in total. So yeah, we've done a lot. It's been fun.
And what are you buying today? What type of deals are you looking at today? And how has that shifted over the last 10, 15 years?
I'd say many years ago, we were more opportunistic. And it was also the state of things in the market. In the mobile home park space, for example, there were a lot of smaller mom and pop mobile home parks that were more rural that you could pick up for 15 to 20, maybe sometime in the mid-20s cap. Which we thought there was a chance for cap rate compression. We didn't think there was much chance for expansion from there. So we really focused on really the lower end, call it 2-star as an average. Mobile home parks are 0 to 5-star in terms of a rating, where the higher is the better. So we were generally in the 2. So we didn't really own the very bottom that you wouldn't feel safe going into, but the roads may not have been paved, might have been private utilities, some park-owned homes, some of those things. Where today, as a general statement, we've really bought a lot higher end. So we really focus on bigger, nicer, more institutional quality, more institutional markets. And the thought behind that is there's also a spectrum in mobile home parks where really when you're starting out, you buy parks where you own all the homes and you rent the homes and the land. But you'll find the home renting business is a really pretty terrible business because you're constantly... You evict somebody and you basically have to rebuild the home. It's very expensive. Or buy a new home, which is, again, very expensive. So we prefer that the residents own their own home. So that's the model we have today, as the majority of the parks we've bought over the last couple of years are generally 150 units or more. They're very well located. They have very few park-owned homes. They're generally 99% occupied or greater, public utilities. So as a result of that, you get a more stable income stream. Because the folks own their own home, there's a longer duration income stream. People who own their home generally stay for 7 years, whereas if they rent their home, they stay for two. So you have a more durable income stream. And then you have a lot more financing options in that the agencies, Fannie and Freddie, will lend, whereas the lower, smaller, rural park-owned homes, you can't get agency financing.
What is your focus today and coming years? Are you still buying mobile home parks? I know you said you did some self-storage. What type of assets are you most interested in today?
The same. I really like mobile home parks. I really like storage. On a personal note, like outside of the fund, if there's a unbelievable deal being given away that is of a different product type, I might jump on that personally. But within the fund context and structure, mobile home parks and storage facilities, I think, still have a lot to offer.
We'll get back to the show with first some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
What markets are you buying in today?
We're pretty much national. Per the product type, there are certain areas we wouldn't buy in, like mobile home parks, for example, wouldn't buy in California, Washington State, New England states, New York, Mississippi, Louisiana, for various, each one their own reason. But as a general rule, there's regulatory risk, there's adverse tenant landlord act policies, climate, culture. New England states, you have declining workforce, population. Each area has their own issues, but there are more areas we would buy in than those that we would not.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about self-storage. So that's something I've never invested in, probably one of my least knowledgeable asset types of real estate. So what initially drew you to self-storage, and what year did you even start in that business?
Storage is kind of a blended story in that we bought a number of mobile home parks over the years that had a storage component on it. It had attached storage, so it was actually a mobile home park with a storage facility attached, and that's kind of where we first started getting exposed to the space. And then we really started deploying capital in and around 2014 to the strategy, specific where we would buy a standalone or invest in a standalone storage facility. But there are a lot of interesting corollaries to mobile home park. If you go back, and this is based on NAREIT, so if you go to NAREIT's data and you look back from base year 2000, really the two best performing asset classes for NOI growth since that time are storage and mobile home parks. But what you'll see is the way that both asset classes got to that end point, they got there differently. And in short, mobile home parks are generally more predictable. The rise over the run is more consistent. Storage is more elastic. There's benefits. In 2001, post-COVID, elasticity was great. Storage, the rental rates flew. In some cases, you were going 20-30% year over year on a same-store basis, which is great. So that elasticity is great when it's running. Mobile home parks, you won't really see that, because I say this very loosely and hypothetically, but even if you could raise rents 20-30%, you probably shouldn't. Probably should show restraint to go into a community and say, we just increased your rents 20%. That's a tough pill to swallow. And as a result, that restraint is shown in the data in that the asset class tends to stay narrower in terms of its growth rate. So it's a little bit more static. Storage is a little bit more elastic. And we like both those qualities, especially in one fund vehicle. To the extent that you put both asset classes in a fund, you have the backbone of one and the elasticity of the other.
Makes sense. Floor is elevated, but you still have a high ceiling there with some of the upside.
Yep.
Makes sense.
Yep. And today, again, to go back to the recent years, post-COVID, 2021, 22, you would have really loved to own storage. But today, you'd really like to own mobile home parks. Storage is now soft, went crazy, and now nationally storage is soft.
Yeah.
And it'll go and grow again. But the point is, that's why we like both.
Okay, so let me recap some of the things I've heard in storage in the last 6 months. So I've heard this discussion where there was a big boom in building, as you mentioned, during COVID and when prices had skyrocketed. So there was this massive construction infill going on everywhere of self-storage facilities. And then it became somewhat oversaturated. You in agreement of all of those theories?
Yeah, supply definitely increased. New starts increased, yeah.
Okay. And what has happened, let's say, in the last 2 years coming out of COVID that has continued to not allow the demand to catch up to supply, so to speak?
Demand is actually softened. So it's not purely supply side, because really our focus when we buy storage is we want to buy where it's very hard to build. So it's not to say that in some cases you can't build, but we want to buy moated real estate as much as we can. So there are properties that we own in the portfolio that you'd be very hard pressed to build if you put significant effort into it. And even if you did, it wouldn't be a scaled entry with multiple entrants. So we try to have as much of a moat in where we buy as possible. But as a general statement, there has been proliferation of storage on the supply side, but at the same time, there's been a softening of demand, obviously the demand side. And a lot of that has to do with housing. One of the stimulants to storage is you're transitioning. You're moving up, you're moving down, you're buying another home in the country because it's work from home, and now they're calling you back. Those kind of movements and friction points are very positive to storage. And I don't think it's much of a secret that home sales, home transactions due to interest rate hikes, transactions have fallen off a cliff on a year-over-year basis. I saw this morning in the Wall Street Journal that the volume has increased. The spring buying season this year is already off to a pretty good start as of this morning, which is great to see. And if that continues, that'll be helpful to storage.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And I'm an agent also here in Southwest Ohio. So yeah, I can relate to the sales side. And it's amazing how the volume in 2021 versus 22 and 23 was shockingly low. But yeah, I also concur with that, that at least in our market, spring season has started to pick up and you're definitely seeing more listings hit the market, which is opening up buyers to having some more opportunity.
And that's positive for storage, because that creates the opportunity for storage to stand in the gap as a solution for those who need it. What we're going through now is corollary to past market cycles. So we're not seeing anything that's necessarily something new, although we're watching it. Our expectation is between now and spring of 2025 for things to really get moving again. Tomorrow's better than a year from now, but at the same time, the business we think is going to be fine.
On these assets, when you're buying these and you're putting these funds together, what is your typical term? Are you looking at these in 3, 5, 7, 10-year plans? Obviously, I know I'm sure every deal and every fund is a little bit different, but what is, generally speaking, your philosophy on that?
There's a couple of corresponding philosophies. In short, and overly simplistic, but not far from the truth, we want to sell bad things, keep good things. And again, generally speaking, 20 years from now, you'll probably regret every good thing you sold prior to that point in time. And I have a funny, quick story to illustrate that. And I mentioned the person because it's meaningful, not as a name drop, but many years ago, I was at dinner with Ben Stein, the actor, comedian, economist, interesting guy. So I was at dinner with Ben in California, and Ben was telling me a story. He said, I bought a house in Beverly Hills for $200,000. Many years later, I sold it for $800,000. And his comment was something to the effect, and I thought the guy was the biggest idiot in the world paying me $800,000 for this house. He just looked at me deadpan. He's like, the house is now worth $7 million. His point was, as much as I thought that person was a fool, that person might have been me. So I think it's a good illustration to long-term asset ownership. So to answer the question in context of what we do, we want to buy assets, add value to them as quickly as we can, return member capital such that their investment basis is zero and there's remaining assets in the fund, and then we own long-term, and then work to provide liquidity to members who might need or want it over time, but not otherwise liquidate the assets.
Okay. Makes sense. I'm going to make an assumption here that at some point in the last 10, 15 years of these funds being generated, that you were also doing cash out refis that a lot of people were doing when rates were low. Is that still happening at all, or have you put the brakes on that?
No, we actually just did a refi, 30 days ago, $150 million refinance. So yeah, we're still doing refinances, but I guess to kind of poke behind the question behind the question a little bit maybe, and it speaks to our model in that we like to stay usually around 50% loan to cost when we buy an asset, which is uber conservative. So 2 years ago, that looked silly. It's like, why would you get 50% if you can get 80%? Well, today, we're not fielding those same questions because the market has shifted. And that's why we do like using debt, but we try to use moderate amounts of debt. And then when we use debt, it's long-term fixed rate debt with very limited exceptions. So today we're not sitting on a portfolio that's levered to the hilt with debt that can't sustain itself, hoping for a miracle in the market to save us, gratefully. So we try to take a real conservative approach to debt and a conservative approach to the assets we buy. So we want to buy real quality assets, really well located, own them long term, manage them well, use moderate amounts of debt.
That makes sense. And of the investors I talk to on the show frequently, the ones that are having the most success in the current market the last couple of years were the ones that had the really conservative underwriting and were not overly leveraged on high loan to values and floating debt, bridge debt. So it makes sense. And obviously in hindsight, I'm sure everybody can see exactly what you have been looking at.
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, and I say this for the newer folks in the industry that are coming up, a lot of times it depends on who's driving the ship. It looked like it was a very smart business decision in the last couple of years to do what the market was asking, so to speak, which was buy whatever super marketable assets using probably too much debt at unfavorable terms in order to maximize yield. So the point is, for us, market cycle, CNBC headlines change, what people want changes. And so our tact, though, is we know what we want, we know where we're going, and we know how we're going to get there. And at some points in the market, we'll be incredibly popular by virtue of alignment around that. And at other times, we won't be popular, and we're okay with that. Like I said, I'm 6'8" and a nerd, so being unpopular is something I'm very used to.
Well, I appreciate all your insights on that. I did hear that you're going to be presenting at the Best Ever Conference coming up in April 9th through 12th. Is that true?
It is. I'm excited about it.
Awesome. Give us a little sneak peek as to what you may be talking about, at least the topic anyway.
Yeah, I will speak to anything that I can that'll add value, but I think they would like me to speak on the difference between multi-asset funds and single asset syndications, pros and cons, observations is what I believe I'm going to be asked to speak on.
Very cool. I'm excited to hear that. And I will also be able to meet and connect with you there. Like I said, April 9th through 12th, for anyone who still doesn't have tickets, you can get them on besteverconference.com. But yeah, looking forward to meeting up with you there.
Yeah, likewise.
All right, you ready to transition to the best ever lightning round?
I'm ready.
Give me your best ever book recommendation.
Ooh, I'll just give you a good one lately. It's nonfiction, which is probably a curveball for your viewers, but it's called The Spy and the Traitor.
Okay. Have not heard that one.
It's obviously a true story, but very James Bond. Bond could have been based on this story. Hard to put down.
Very cool. Yeah. Okay, give me a best ever way you like to give back.
I would say it's the same. It's a plumb line through everything we do. The reason we operate the way we do and all the way. But I really like investing locally into community and relationships. I kind of love thy neighbor.
Cool. Give me a mistake you made in one of your deals and the lesson you learned from it.
I'd say the biggest mistake. There's a deal we bought years ago. It's a mobile home park we bought years ago, and the seller falsified their numbers. So it was initially a mistake because we got in day one and it was very apparent that what was to be wasn't, what we expected wasn't there. But thankfully we had them sign and therefore certify the information they provided. So when we elevated it to a point of legal risk, we were able to retrade post-closing. And because we had leverage, gratefully due to diligence, and we ended up coming out way ahead. So that was a full 360 deal. And that was many years ago.
Okay. So they were concerned with legal liability. So they were willing to retrade on value.
Yeah. We had them dead to rights.
Okay. Very cool. And where can our audience connect with you and learn more about your business?
Our website is elevationcapitalgroup.com. My number is 407-602-7662. Reach out anytime if I can be helpful.
Ryan, I appreciate you joining us. I know it's been several years since you've been on the show, so we appreciate you coming back and recapping your story and giving us all your strategies you're working on today. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Again, looking forward to seeing you at the Best Ever Conference in April. And best ever listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a 5-star review, share this episode with somebody who may benefit from it. Remember to follow and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss anything. Thank you all and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.